is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Megan Kamrick. The 2016 presidential election is turning out to be one of the most polarizing contests in recent history. A study earlier this year by the Pew Research Center found ideological divisions between Democrats and Republicans are more pronounced and views of the opposing party more negative than at any time in at least a quarter century. That polarization is particularly evident on issues of race, class, and gender. We want to delve into those issues today and explore how they're playing out in this election. Martha Burke is a political psychologist and author of Your Voice, Your Vote, The Savvy Woman's Guide to Power, Politics, and the Change We Need. Martha, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Gender has suffused this election from the start since Hillary Clinton entered the race. And we also have a female third-party candidate, Jill Stein. There was much discussion in 2008 about how Barack Obama's candidacy highlighted unfinished issues around race in this country. Is this happening with gender in this election?
Well, it's trying to happen, Megan. It seems to get overshadowed by some of the more salacious issues, shall we say. But yes, Hillary Clinton is talking about issues that women have historically cared the most about, keeping abortion legal, having some kind of child care system other than the make-do system that we have now. Equal pay always polls number one with women.
But are these issues, are you saying that we're trying to talk about these issues, but it's not necessarily happening?
I'm saying that the candidate, Hillary has talked about it from the first, but it's getting drowned out by some of these other issues. However, she has drugged Donald Trump along. He's proposed a child care tax deduction, which actually is highly regressive and will not be good for lower income women, but I don't think he understands that. The important part is that he has finally noticed child care.
Now, I'm assuming most of you're saying it's being drowned out by other issues. Most of the focus this past week has been on the attitudes of Donald Trump toward women, revealed by a tape where he speaks lewdly about them and brags about groping them. Could gender then be the issue that dictates the outcome in this race?
Seems like it. There's been one poll since the tape, the infamous tape, came out. And they had, it's interesting because they had started the poll before the tape came out, and then about 44% of the respondents were called after the tape came out. It showed a 33% gender gap between women and men on who they support.
Is that unprecedented?
Absolutely. The gender gap has been with us. For those listeners who may not know what that means, it's the difference in how women and men vote for a given candidate, whether it's the winner or the loser. And it's been with us since 1980, when Reagan ran against Carter and the Equal Rights Amendment was pretty much in the public debate. So this is unprecedented. The gender gap has been historically about 8 percentage points between women and men. Women will vote for or against one candidate or the other 8% more than men. 33% is off the charts.
So Trump has fought back with allegations about Bill Clinton, and for some of our younger listeners, we might remind them, Mr. Clinton saying he may have engaged in locker room talk, but he says he never abused women and is reminding voters of Clinton's affair with a White House intern and allegations by women from his political career in Arkansas. But now women are coming forward to say Trump did grope them. So could we hope for some serious progress on sexual harassment or abuse in light of all this?
For some of our younger voters, let me say that back when Anita Hill accused Clarence Thomas during the hearings on the Supreme Court nomination,
1995.
Early 90s, yeah. I can't remember, we thought that was going to be a watershed because Thomas was a harasser. It was documented. And it did make some waves, but it went away. And so I hope that this time there will be more long-term attention paid to it. Let me say this about Trump's accusations versus Clinton. Trump would like us to believe that every woman that accuses him is a liar, but every woman that accused Bill Clinton is saying the gospel truth. Now, it's hard for him to have it both ways. Having said that, I'd like to remind everyone, all of us, Bill Clinton is not on the ballot.
But people have criticized Hillary for standing by him, and he's even accused her of attacking the women who
he has accused her of that. That is undocumented, and believe me, back in the day when this all happened, people really dug into it. What I have said in my blog about it is, A, he is not on the ballot, and B, what she has done in trying to stand by her man, if you will, is the same thing that scores of women have done throughout history to save their marriage, perhaps save their careers. Who can get into their head and know the motivation? I don't know what Trump would have had her do other than try to defend what she thought was right in her own marriage.
We are also joined in the studio by Professor Annette Rodriguez. She's a lecturer in American Studies at UNM in the Chicano Studies Department. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we speak of the women's vote, we can't really generalize across half the population. I mean, some women are actually making light of what they heard in those tapes. Boys will be boys, or they point out that women can speak lewdly or demeaningly towards men. So what are they hearing from the GOP campaign that's speaking to them in a way that somehow the Democratic campaign is not?
Thank you for having me. I think one of the issues that we have here in thinking about both gender and race is that, as far as I see it, we have almost a contentless 4 weeks ahead of us, right? It's all circus is no bread. Right. And so what we have is two campaigns who are not thinking about persistent income inequality, not thinking about or talking about the restructuring of Medicaid. While we know that the GOP is having a campaign that for me looks like a series of anti-immigrant rallies, right, with the Trump campaign, we don't have any policies on the Democratic side, particularly for Latinos, that make us feel any better. We have the Obama administration that had the highest number of deportations historically, that used immigrant detention with women and children. And so women of color in particular are looking at different kinds of issues that I think neither of the campaigns are focusing on, because we have this spectacular reactive media that's talking about things like vulgar language, the past behavior. We have sort of a politics of personal destruction that's not talking about this six-year recession that has yet to rebound for household income. We have a number of communities of color and women of color who lost all the capital they had when housing rates fell. Those haven't recovered. And so there are other issues that economically marginalized people are thinking about, that women are thinking about. And it's not simply questions of reproductive justice, right? And so I think we're finding that there are a lot of issues that are not being addressed. And I think this works for both candidates.
I was struck by, and perhaps I'm being a reactive media, on Twitter, I saw a picture of a supporter at a Trump rally with a T-shirt with his wife next to him that said, "She's a C word, mm-hmm. Use your imagination, vote for Trump." And someone quickly responded on Twitter with a picture from 2008, mm-hmm. and it said, "Sarah Palin is a C word." So I'm are we normalizing this language, or does this help to bring to the forefront that people are talking about women this way?
I really fear that we're normalizing this language, and I think it has a profound effect on kids, boys and girls, and it is a coarsening of the culture, and I don't think that's good for the country. To normalize degradation of people whether women or men, is just not a good trend. I'd like to add to what our colleague just said about women of color and the addressing of the issues they care about. One big issue is the minimum wage. And neither candidate has come out for a raise in the minimum wage up to what the progressive groups are saying, you know, fight for $15 an hour seems to be the minimum that progressive groups feel a family can even begin to live on. Hillary has said, I think, $12 after some back and forth. Trump, he's either everybody's making enough money, which he said, or once he said 10 bucks. but that is an issue that because women are the majority of minimum wage workers, adult women, not teenagers, and the majority are women of color. So my colleague is absolutely right. This is getting ignored.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We want to hear from you. Do you think it's good that gender issues are becoming part of the broader public conversation during this campaign? Or do you think talking about this is creating more division? Also, what about race and its role in the election? Join our conversation. You can call 877-899-5866 or email callinshow@kunm.org. We're also tweeting at KUNM News. Also in the studio, we have Finney Coleman. He is an associate professor in the UNM English Language and Literature Department, and he teaches a class on Black Lives Matter. Thank you for joining us, Professor Coleman.
Thank you for having me.
So a poll by The Washington Post and ABC News found that views about the influence of men, women, and racial groups in society closely align with vote preferences. Clinton supporters are far more likely to say minorities and women have too little influence. And far fewer Trump supporters agree that women and minorities have too little influence. They're far less likely to say this. It's a big gap. So is this election just bringing these divisions to light, or is it exacerbating them? Is it making them worse?
No, I don't think that it's bringing these issues to light in ways that aren't obvious to people who actually are involved in these issues mm-hmm. on a daily basis. Most people who are able to ignore these issues, for them, yes, perhaps. This is the first time that they've heard about, you know, stop and frisk, or the first time that they've heard about racial profiling. Sometimes people will imagine that a lot of the racial implications of Black Lives Matter that those things are new. They aren't. They've been around as long as our nation's been around. It's just that in election cycles, they become more prominent, more salient.
So Mr. Trump has said that he tweeted a lot of things about women before this. He has said and tweeted. He's on Twitter a lot, as we all know, a lot of things about women before this recent videotape, before the most recent allegations. Why did this episode tip the scales so much for people?
Well, I think this time you had his own words. You had a videotape that couldn't be relegated to the pile of rumor or innuendo. And the language was vulgar and clear cut. It was, you know, some years ago, but undeniable. And also I think there was a subtext to that conversation, kind of leering, ogling. I think probably the most damaging part of that tape wasn't so much the Trump talking about his conquests and the like, but the reaction that he had as they actually arrived on the scene and this attractive young woman was standing there, and the just juvenile way that he and Billy Bush spoke about this young woman as they arrived, and the kind of antics that took place just as they came off the bus. And it is stunning to me that there are defenders of that action who say that this, when asked, is this something that you would look for out of someone that's running for the highest office in our country? It just stuns me that people can defend that action. I wouldn't accept that out of any of the teenagers that I work with. I certainly wouldn't expect it out of a candidate for the presidency of the United States.
Now, I people are saying, oh, but guys talk like this all the time. I will say, I've had several people say to me, I was in a fraternity and on an athletic team. I was in a lot of locker rooms They're telling me I didn't talk like that. They said vulgar things, but not
some of the athletes have come out, professional athletes, and said, not in our locker room. And I don't know whether the team said, boys, you better get out there because there's a lot of predatory behavior by some well-known athletes.
Right, there
or
is.
Or not, but it was interesting to me that the locker room groups came out and said, not us. Mm-hmm.
And I've been in locker rooms all my life, and it's rare that I've heard that kind of language. That doesn't mean that that kind of language is never expressed in the locker room. But one, he wasn't in a locker room. Two, even if he were in a locker room, only a certain type of human being in those locker rooms engages in that type of behavior and talk. And we don't expect the lowest common denominator in our elected officials, but the highest common denominator in terms of morality, maturity, and just good common sense.
Professor Rodriguez, you know, several columnists have noted that this outrage over Mr. Trump's most recent remarks came because they could picture their wives and daughters as the objects of the comments. That outrage seemed to be muted when he was making comments, they say, about Latinos and African Americans. Is that a fair criticism?
I think it is, and it's one that I've made myself. I think the question of respect and appropriate behavior toward women, that's not something that, you know, people went after when Trump opened. I mean, this is the opening to his presidential run. He opened it by saying that Mexicans were rapists and murderers. And that is the kind of categorical statement that is offensive, that is false. So that is how he opened his campaign. And then he continued with anti-black remarks. He continued with all sorts of racist remarks. We had violence at each of his rallies. These kinds of things were clearly unacceptable from the beginning when we talk about character, when we talk about maturity, when we talk about behavior. Certainly his vulgar language is misogynistic. There's no denying it. But to me, his behavior, his pattern of behavior, and his insults to a number of people in marginalized positions have been unacceptable from the beginning.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to talk about race and gender and class in the 2016 election.
Support for KUNM comes from UNM Press, publisher of general interest and scholarly books on the history, literature, ecology, and cultures of the American West. More information and book selections online at unmpress.com.
Help KUNM celebrate its first 50 years. Join us at the historic Chemo Theater in downtown Albuquerque for a special evening with native New Mexican Linda Wertheimer, NPR's respected senior news analyst and longtime anchor of All Things Considered. That's Sunday, October 23rd at 6 p.m., co-presented with the JCC. Tickets at the Chemo box office or click the link at KUNM.org.
It's a story of revenge. King Frederick the Great tried to humiliate Johann Sebastian Bach by giving him an awkward tune and asking him to improvise around it. Well, King Fred was good, but Bach was great. The story and Bach's revenge, played by the Los Angeles Philharmonic, on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick, and today we're talking about the election through the lens of race, class, and gender. What are you hearing from campaigns about these issues? Are they impacting your vote this year? Call now, 877-899-5866. You can also email callinshow at kunm.org. Professor Finney Coleman with the UNM English Language and Literature Department, you teach a class on Black Lives Matter. The second presidential debate last Sunday was held in St. Louis near Ferguson, Missouri. That's where protests erupted following the shooting of Michael Brown in 2014. It's considered a key moment, a key place in the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement. Race and policing did come up in the first debate, but what do you make of the fact that Black Lives Matter never came up in Sunday's debate?
my initial conclusion was that there had to be some collusion for that not to come up, both from, you know, Hillary Clinton's camp and Donald Trump's. I wouldn't claim that to be true, but at least one has to wonder why and how they could be that close to the epicenter of this movement, and how important it has been in kind of shaping racial politics climate over the last 2 years, and then not to have a word spoken about this. I couldn't find any explanation that was reasonable.
Do you see any of the issues such as systemic racism and inequality in the justice system that are central to the Black Lives Matter movement being addressed in the campaign, in the election?
Certainly not to the degree that I'd like to see them addressed, and I think that most Americans would like to see them addressed. You know, one of the things that the Black Lives Matter movement tries to do is to bring these issues to the forefront of our discussion so that we don't have clashes, so that we don't have incidents where, you know, people are harmed in the streets, or that we have these injustices like stop and frisk. And we seem to think that Black Lives Matter is just about police shootings. And that's certainly an important part of what has happened in this country, that Black Lives Matter tries to address. But it's not the only thing. Black Lives Matter takes up the mantle from the civil rights movement, from the Black Power movement, a melding of these different ideas and these different strategies to address these issues. And so when I look at this this election cycle, we have to wonder if the candidates aren't addressing these issues during their candidacies, what tells us or suggests to us or should suggest to us that they're going to do anything about these issues if and when they become president of the United States?
When Barack Obama ran for president, there was an attitude among some, especially some white people in the U.S., like, oh, well, OK, I guess that means we fixed racism. What impact has that idea had on addressing the systemic racial issues and inequality we're still faced with?
The election of President Obama?
Yeah, well, the idea like, oh, well, I guess we solved that.
Well, I think the mythologies of post-raciality, I think there has always been, especially on, I think, on the left, a desire to move to a space where race was something that we'd conquered, that we'd moved beyond, that we've gotten beyond. But the realities crept up during that campaign. We've very rarely seen political candidates receive the kind of racist vitriol that President Obama did, both in his election and re-election campaigns. The kind of images that were circulated about him, the stories that were circulated about him, and then, frankly, the birther issue. This is something that even presidents who have had questions about their origins, their birth, people like John McCain, have not been subjected to that kind of scrutiny. And I should also point out, there wasn't this hue and cry initially about the birther movement. There's more of a curiosity about it than a simple disavowing of that as a strategy to discredit this candidate.
We have an email comment from Wendy. She says she found a campaign button from 1984 when Walter Mondale ran with Geraldine Ferraro with a demeaning reference to women's breasts. She says that kind of campaigning has been happening for a long time. So, Martha, I wanted to ask you about that. Similar to the question I just asked Professor Coleman, many people might feel once we get a female president, those issues will be solved. And there are some longstanding gender inequality issues like the pay gap that haven't gone away. What impact will having a woman as president have on those?
Well, it depends on the woman, of course, because if you look at history and other countries, we're way behind other countries in terms of even considering a woman.
Is that because they have a parliament or because they've mandated quotas?
It's both.
Okay.
In the Nordic countries, there are quotas for parliament.
And in Rwanda.
And many countries have a different kind of system of electings where the parties get so many seats. You know, it's starts with a P.
Proportional representation.
And so that tends to help women. But back to your question, it depends on whether the woman elected and her cohorts in the Congress are willing to bring the issues up. You know, there are many women who could be elected. I would say Sarah Palin might have been one who wouldn't have looked at these issues in very much depth, if at all. They would consider, for example, child care is something that people tend to want to say, well, that's just a family issue. It has nothing to do with society in general. Why should we have any kind of systemic or national child care system? Well, there was a time when public schools were controversial. Only the rich had schools. There were no public schools, and people considered that to be a family issue. So we have to move these things. I think Clinton will talk about it. She is talking about it. She's pretty much being drowned out. But so much is going to depend on whether there is a Congress that also wants to talk about it. And yeah, we might come to the place someday where we say, it's all fixed. But women are what we're about 23% of the U.S. Congress right now. And so the feminist majority did the math. And at this rate, it's going to be another 150 years before we reach parity. So that's where we are.
So we'll all see it if we're Vulcans and we live that long.
Yeah.
We have a call from Greg. He's calling from Acoma Pueblo. Greg, are you there? What would you like to say?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Thank you.
What is your question this
morning?
Hello? Go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm sorry. I didn't have a question per se. I was just following along the discussion this morning, and I apologize for if I'm not coming in clearly. I'm on the road.
No, you're fine.
I just wanted to lend the comment into the discussion regarding race and gender. But before so doing, as a Native American, I'll just speak for myself. I think I've, as a Native American living on the reservation, I've watched American government from maybe a different perspective than most. And what I've seen is that the creators of the American government and the vision that they have in creating this government and the Constitution, all men and women are created equal, so forth and so on. I think that's coming to fruition. And I'm personally am glad to see that. I'm glad to see a black president. I am glad to see a woman running for president. And I think most people nationally are also agreeing with that, maybe that kind of perspective. While on the other side, there's others that are voting, for example, or rallying behind Donald Trump because they think they're not seeing the kind of country that they have been used to, so to speak. And all I can say to those supporters, to those Trump supporters, is, as a Native American, welcome to my world. I mean, we've been on the outside and not in the mainstream ever since Columbus arrived. So I'm curious to see how this is turning out. But I just want to thank you for drawing some attention to this. I'm so glad to see Hillary Clinton running. And I think that this is a turning point for America, and I hope that we keep the momentum going regarding inclusivity and gender equality moving forward. Thank you very much
for calling, Greg. Appreciate that comment. Martha, you wanted to say something?
I did. Thank you, caller, for bringing that up. I think it's very important to note that Native American women particularly have been left out of the discussion for way too long. And you take the pay gap, for example, Native American women are at the very bottom in terms of the overall pay gap. And for years and years, the people that were looking at this didn't even include Native American women. Now they do. It started out just all women. Then they cut it by white women and African American women.
You mean looking at the pay
looking
stats.
At the pay disparities between women and men. Added Latinas as they went along. And Native American women were the very last ones to be looked at. And you still see different kinds of surveys that leave these women out. I think it's wonderful that they're starting to be included, but we have a long way to go. One thing that I looked at some of the gender gaps on issues in general for this election. And the largest gender gaps between women and men are women are much more concerned, all women, about racial and ethnic relationships and how minorities are being treated in this country. And so I think some of Trump's crassness has brought that to the fore, where others that maybe never thought about it so much are looking at it. At least I hope so.
That's a great segue into Professor Gabriel Sanchez, who's on the line with us. He's a professor of political science at UNM, and he's a principal with Latino Decisions, which focuses on Latino political opinion research. Are you there, Professor Sanchez?
I am. Thanks for having me on. Great discussion so far.
One poll you did recently found a gender gap within the Latino vote, a substantial one, because Latinas and Hispanic women are moving away from the Republicans or the Republican candidate this year. And you found this election could have the biggest gender gap in history. Why is this happening?
Well, I think it's twofold. I mean, obviously, you know, the big picture narrative is that, hey, there's an opportunity to vote in the first female president in American history. So there's that narrative. But obviously, and I agree with the last point that was made, I think the underlying issues related to gender equality have been symbolized by Donald Trump's campaign and some of the most recent comments that have come to light. But I think that's perceived, at least by most Latinas, Latino females, that it's not really a Donald Trump effect, that there's been that underlying notion within the Republican Party for some time, and now it's just being crystallized by this particular campaign. So you're seeing a major movement towards the Democratic Party in terms of projected vote choice. But the other, probably more important piece to the gap, if you will, between men and women among Latinos is an enthusiasm to vote. But we're seeing a significant difference with, you know, females on the Latino side being less projected, at least to be less likely to vote. And a lot of it is, you know, do they perceive that their voices are being heard and that voting is a mechanism for reform on gender equality issues? So that's one thing just to pay attention to that most folks aren't talking about is the turnout gap. Will Latinas be enthused to go out and vote in this election? And if they don't, what does that mean for, you know, the ability to see reform, particularly with this Congress?
What did you want to say, Professor Rodriguez?
I want to say that what's interesting for me about this election, especially as we come to this last 4 weeks, is this question of turnout. I mean, I think we've got the two most historically unpopular candidates here. And we have people becoming more and more depressed by this news as it trickles out, whether we're talking about leaked emails, whether we're talking about shifts in policy or changes in policy that are happening on both sides in terms of discussions, whether we're talking about not only vulgarity, but actual sexual assault by potentially one of our candidates. And so for me, what we're looking at is the question of turnout. I think voters are becoming disgusted and demoralized. And I don't know how many are going to be excited about, you know, running to the polls for either of these candidates.
I want to take, we have a few callers. Kevin in Santa Fe wanted to talk about Mr. Trump's, the allegations against him this week. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yes, I was just wondering why no one's addressing the comfortable conversation him and Billy Bush had about sexual assault. Everyone's talking about the vulgarity in language, but what they're describing and seem very comfortable with is actually assaulting women.
That's correct, caller.
Well, and Mr. Trump did say that these were words.
Well, he said it, and he denied that he had ever done it. In the debate, he flatly, as the news media is all reporting now, he lied to the American people because women who were the victims have come forward and
they have allegations.
Well,
he has not been convicted.
But what the lawyers are saying is this, that did they at the time tell others about what happened? That tends to legitimize what they're saying, even if it's 5-10-year-old allegation, rather than just, oh, now they came out. Well, in these cases, the New York Times did substantiate that at the time they told their friends, in one case their husband, about what happened. And that tends to legitimize the complaints far more than something that's a 10-year-old allegation with no substantial.
We have another caller who wants to talk about this. Amber from Albuquerque, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have a really similar comment to what Kevin just said. And that's what I heard the panel, the commentators earlier in the show talking about the video that came out regarding Donald Trump and sort of dancing around the issue and talking about the vulgarity as if that was the problem. I don't think anybody is surprised to hear vulgarity come out of Donald Trump's mouth. The problem here is his saying that he is entitled to grab women, touch women, kiss women without their consent because of who he is and the power that he has. And I think it's important that we don't ignore that. The issue is not that he said a disgusting word. It's that he articulated and is entitled to a disgusting concept that is illegal and should be condemned in our society.
That's a very good point, Amber. Yes, and a lot of people this week have talked about the fact that what he was saying is that he could do these things with impunity because of who he is. We have another caller, Sarah from Albuquerque. Sarah, you wanted to talk about elections making a difference.
Yes, you know, I really do feel that elections do matter. I feel that, like a lot of the Gary Johnson libertarian people, they say, well, doesn't make any difference whether Donald Trump gets elected. What is the big deal about that? But, you know, for people on the economic bottom totem pole, I'm on SSI disability. You know, it's a difference of getting a free phone with 250 minutes. So it's a big deal for us, you know, people that don't have much money. So I think it does make a difference. But I just wanted to remind people that one place is open to vote right now, 1500 Lomas, the County Clerk Annex. And it's going to be open until November 5th, all next 3 weeks. And so it's by 12th and Lomas. And so we have early voting going on right now. And 243-VOTE is the number, 243-8683. So, but it does matter. You know, the thing is that you want a president that's going to give you five things, help you out, or just take 10 things away from you. That's the difference. It's not much, but it does matter.
Okay. Thank you for reminding us about that, Sarah. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We're going to pick up this discussion right after this break.
Want to give KUNM a great 50th anniversary present? How about donating your old car or truck? October is our anniversary month, so if you call now, it will be towed and sold, and we will get the proceeds before October ends. You will get a tax deduction and a KUNM membership, which entitles you to many benefits, including free admission to the Social Justice Fair. It takes just one call to 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Picking a college major is a big decision. For some, it's a way to secure a high-paying job. Knowing the track you want to follow also gives students the opportunity to develop necessary skills. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with experts about choosing a college major. We hope you'll join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
It's the KUNM Call-In Show. We're talking about race, gender, and class in the elections this year. We're with Gabriel Sanchez, political science professor at UNM, political psychologist Martha Burke, Professor Finney Coleman, who teaches a class on Black Lives Matter at UNM, and Annette Rodriguez with the UNM Department of Chicana and Chicano Studies. Early voting has begun in New Mexico, as our caller reminded us. Are these issues impacting your decision as you head into the voting booth? Are you a person of color or a woman who finds no candidate is speaking to you? Are you struggling in this economy? Do you hear anything from candidates that you think will change that? Gabe Sanchez, our caller, brought up the issue of being low income. She's on SSI disability. Class has come up in this election in new ways. And there has been good economic news of late about higher median incomes, lower poverty rates. That follows years of economic stagnation for a lot of people. We keep hearing about working class white men being a big base of support for Trump. Is that why we're finally talking about class?
Well, I think that's a big part of it, and it really brings up the notion of how race is kind of the backdrop of this election, but it's coloring essentially all aspects of this. So when you think about social class and economic policy, you know, when you think about the last debate and how it's being framed, you know, in the context of minorities essentially, you know, living in quote-unquote hell, I think for a lot of folks of color, they hear those messages and say, well, that doesn't necessarily resonate with how they feel about their own communities, even though they realize that economically they have struggled and rebound from the recession has been much more difficult for people of color. So I think that narrative is finally at least being discussed in some detail. What we haven't seen, and I think this is what voters are looking for, is what are the exact policy proposals from both candidates that are going to actually improve on the ground the lives of individuals that are on the lower end of the economic spectrum. And I think that's what folks are hungry for, you know, not that the narrative around perceptions of where class is in this country and class warfare, but really what are we going to do in terms of policy to continue what we are seeing in terms of good news out of the last couple of years of President Obama's administration. We're making progress. So folks want to know, are we going to continue that, or are we going to start over with a whole brand new set of policies?
Well, it's interesting. Sometimes I hear people supporting Donald Trump as more of these allegations come out. There's just this huge hunger for change. They don't know what it looks like. They're frustrated. You know, we could go on for an entire several shows about the dissatisfaction with the American political system. But is that why all of a sudden he's attractive to some people? They're just, you know, Annette brought up, like, people just don't want, they're depressed. They don't want to engage. They don't want to vote. And somehow he's sparking that interest.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep in mind that kind of notion of lack of trust in government, losing faith in government, and disapproval, particularly for Congress, that's not new. That's not a Donald Trump effect. That's been in play for the last several years. I think he just really touched a nerve with being able to come in at the right time where that public mood was definitely moving in the anti-direction. And he's able to say, look, I'm not an establishment candidate. If you're thinking about something completely different, pick me versus Hillary Clinton, who has, you know, probably the most political experience of any presidential candidate. So you have that backdrop, and I think at least early on in his campaign, he really touched that with a large segment of the American population. However, keep in mind that his numbers have been pretty stable over time. He hasn't grown his base per se. So whatever momentum in the electorate, he's already captured it, and he's not likely to grow that much further than he already has.
Well, I mean, that does raise the question. I guess I'll ask Professor Coleman. You know, most African Americans I've seen in the polls are going to not vote for Mr. Trump. But it also, do the Democrats just take this vote for granted? And what does that mean in terms of addressing issues?
Well, this is something that's been trending, where Democrats tend to take the black vote for granted since the 1964 election. So you kind of have to understand the impact of the 64 election and the 1948 election and how our political parties have moved away from platform-based politics to ideologically based politics. And we're seeing the maturation of that. And one of the, I think, unfortunate parts of that maturation is that you can start to see groups like African-Americans and Latinos, political parties can start to take that segment of the vote for granted. And I think that's clearly one of the concerns within the black community, that these candidates simply assume that blacks are going to vote for them and don't have to then risk anything by actually engaging with those groups and finding out what their needs might be and then working to address some of those needs. I think Gabe probably is better prepared to talk about this than I am, but it seems to me it is to the Democrats, at least to their detriment, to ignore the minority vote this year, because as we've talked about all along, voter turnout is going to be critically important to whether or not just, you know, the down ballot races, how those are going to turn out. I think that the presidential we obviously can't call that election now, but I think Gabe's right. I think that base is at work. It's solid. I don't think it's going to move. But I think Hillary Clinton also has a base that isn't going to move. The voters who are going to shift around and move, the undecided voters, I don't think that the black community is, you know, makes up a large percentage of that demographic.
We have a couple of callers. I just want to go through real quick. Paul and T. Harris, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, with all the talk of the presidential election, I don't really know how much that is playing into, you know, daily life for regular folks. And, you know, last night's protest with the police getting off, well, you know, getting a mistrial, but on the Boyd case and seeing, I was down there, I saw all these paramilitary guys down there, militia guys with their guns, saying they were there to help the police. And, you know, I think this election is more about, for regular folks, is about declaring our humanity and whether or not we want to go back to where huge groups of people were not not considered human, or whether we want to push forward and bring, you know, the rest of humanity into the fold of humanity. And I feel like that's where the tension is at for a lot of people. I think what nobody talks about often enough is how the identity for us as white people for so long has been hinged on being superior. And whether or not that it gets expressed in outright racism, it obviously allows for other peoples to be murdered without any consequence and without any outrage, really, by the general population. So that's where I hope this is. That's what this is about: is getting us to a place where, you know, now we have gay people who can be married. You know, Black Lives Matter is doing their thing, but we should all be, you know, supporting Black Lives Matter, and we should be also supporting better education and homeless people not being murdered in the desert.
Okay. All right.
So.
Thank you so much, Paul, for that. I just want to inject a real quick email comment from Paula. She says she's concerned that conversations about race, class, and gender in the election are distracting people from the question at hand, mainly who should lead our country. She says the choices are grim and the American people aren't getting an accurate picture of the candidates because of sensationalism and bias in the media. She points out that disrespectful language is everywhere, online and TV, yet people are afraid to speak their opinion for fear of being crucified in the media. Quick, another call from Marianne in Albuquerque. You're on the air, Marianne.
Good morning. I just want to say that Donald Trump is not a good person because he has no compassion for Americans with disabilities, who are overweight, who are minorities, and who are women. I've already voted for Hillary. I think that she has shown that she's intelligent enough to address issues like housing, employment, education, child care, and she has a lot of minority friends. And I think she's a very tough woman who really had to suffer a lot by what her husband did. And that all rapists, all sexual assault people are bad, and they come from all races, and they don't belong in the White House. And I am a woman that is an American, an educated American Indian. I've lived in Albuquerque for 25 years, and I pray for the people back home, because in America, on reservations, people still don't have electricity and running water.
Okay.
And I'd like to make this point, and I'd also like to say that hopefully the next commentator for the last debate, in all fairness, will turn off Trump's microphone when he tries to bully Hillary by talking over her and yelling and just being the way he normally is. And I'd also like to say that my brothers and my father, my grandfather, never talked the way Donald Trump talks. And so he's acting like he's talking for all men. He's not.
Okay.
He acts like it's okay, and it is not. It is not okay.
Thank you, Marianne, for that comment. I appreciate that. Annette, you've been wanting to say something.
Well, I mean, I think this is something that Martha mentioned sort of at the top of the hour when we started talking that is so important, which is we know that voting has, you know, consequences, but without significant changes in Congress, the question of shifting policy is not going to happen. And I think that's what I worry about in terms of disenfranchised populations, right? That when we are turned off by this dialogue, by the question of character, by probably a third debate that will be focused on the P word and the C word, right? that we're not voting down ballot. And that's what worries me in terms of policy decisions. In terms of Indian country, we're talking about an expansion of fracking. We're talking about the DAPL, the Keystone Pipeline, positions that Hillary Clinton has shifted on several times. And so not being able to hold either of these candidates accountable to policy, as Professor Sanchez pointed out, makes it very difficult for voters to get excited about getting to that ballot box.
Gabe Sanchez, Professor Coleman brought this up too. The down ballot races, what impact do you see from the presidential election, the down ballot races, if we're going to talk about changes in Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, twofold. One, we know from previous recent elections that particularly minority voters definitely feel that way. Hey, presidential election comes around, the candidates, the parties, they all look to mobilize us because they need the votes, and then nothing actually happens in terms of policy response. So remember, in 2012, we had huge surges in turnout among Latino and African-American voters, and then some of the lowest turnout in American history for those populations in 2014, because that's exactly what happened. Hey, what happened? What did we get rewarded with for all of that energy we put into the election? So I think that's something to take a look at. And then down-ballot races, you know, the million-dollar question that everybody's asking is, will this kind of surge against Donald Trump lead to a huge wave that will impact, the likelihood of congressional races, state legislative races, et cetera? Right now, we're not really seeing that enthusiasm carrying its way through. And that could be a big problem because, as everybody's noting, although the American public is highly fixated on the presidential, it's all those down-ballot races, particularly Congress, that will have a much bigger impact on actual policy change and folks feeling as though government's being responsive to their needs and interests.
Well, one of the huge, huge things is the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And if the court goes the way it has gone and the Republicans remain in power, we're going to be looking at a more corporate court or a divided court because nobody can get confirmed. And it is a huge issue, I think, for abortion rights, for racial justice, for transgender issues that are going to be coming up. And people need to pay attention to that.
Go ahead, Professor Coleman.
I think also the stagnation in Congress hasn't gone unnoticed by the American people. And as I think all of us have alluded to, the problems that we're facing as a country aren't new problems. These are problems that have been festering. And whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement, whether it's what we saw out of Bernie Sanders supporters, or frankly what we've seen out of the Tea Party, what we see in our country, there is a growing distrust for government and a growing dissatisfaction with government. And then what that government means in our local community, whether that's policing, whether it's our schools. I think there's a wide range of issues that go untouched in presidential elections, and this has been a gift to the candidates to be able to stay away from the real issues that matter to the people.
Real quickly, as we go out, Professor Rodriguez, what about after the election? Can we recover from such a bruising contest? Is it even possible?
You know, I think no matter which candidate ends up in the White House, we're going to have the same kind of intransigence we've seen. And I'm really worried for questions of police brutality, mass incarceration. These are policies that we don't see being addressed.
That's all the time we have today, but the conversation doesn't have to end. You can tweet us at KUNM News or share your comments on the KUNM call-in show page at KUNM.org. We have more links and resources there as well. Martha Burke is political psychologist, author of Your Voice, Your Vote, The Savvy Women's Guide to Power, Politics, and the Change We Need. Finney Coleman is associate professor, American Literary Studies at UNM. Annette Rodriguez is a lecturer in Chicana and Chicano Studies, the University of New Mexico as well. And Gabriel Sanchez, professor of political science, UNM. Thank you all for joining us today. On our engineer today was Marino Spencer. Anna Landy answered your calls. Sarah Trujillo live tweeted the show. And Elaine Baumgartel is the executive producer. Next Thursday morning at 8, we'll feature some of the best segments of the KUNM call-in show during our fall fundraising campaign. And then we'll be back with a live conversation about the issues you don't hear candidates talking about this election season, the ones you want to hear them talking about. The call-in show is back on Thursday, October 27th at 8 a.m. here on KUNM. Thank you for joining us. I'm Megan Kamrick. This is KUNM.